From Pacifica Station KPFK in Los Angeles, this is Free Speech Radio News. It's Monday, March 16, 2009. Marxist rebels turned political party the FMLN sweep the polls in El Salvador. The Red Cross details the torture of prisoners under the Bush administration. And the Obama administration announces plans to help small businesses during the Great Recession. I'm Aura Bogado. Those stories after this news.
I'm Nell Abram with the headlines for Free Speech Radio News. In Madagascar today, dozens of soldiers and armored tanks forcibly entered one of the nation's presidential compounds and ordered those inside to vacate the building. This after opposition leader Andry Rajoelina called for both the resignation of the nation's president and his arrest on charges of high treason. President Ravalo Manan, who was not in the palace at the time, has said he will not resign, while Rajoelina has refused to participate in a referendum. Also today, the Indian Ocean Islands new army chief, who assumed his position last week after staging a mutiny, declared his support for the opposition. Thousands of Tamil Tigers supporters demonstrated in Brussels today, calling on European Union foreign ministers meeting there to send observers to the war zone and to bring an end to what they call the genocide in Sri Lanka. Also today, the United Nations accused the LTTE rebels of forcibly recruiting a UN staffer. FSRN's Ponia Manikavasagam has more.
The United Nations accusation comes 2 days after a top government medical official in the area announced all surgeries had been stopped due to a severe shortage of important medicines, including anesthetic and blood bags. Dr. Thurairaja Varadaraja said the medical staff was using bed sheets for bandages, while sticks were used as splints to treat fractured limbs. The closure of the hospital would put the lives of thousands of sick and injured people in the conflict zone at extreme risk. The military said on Monday the troops were within a kilometer of a no-fire zone in a fast-shrinking rebel territory. The government accuses the rebels of using some 70,000 civilians trapped in the conflict as human shields, but the International Red Cross puts the number of trapped civilians closer to 150,000. Yesterday alone, the military says that more than 1,000 have fled, nearly half of them are children. Although the rebels have not responded to the UN's accusation, they have been denying the charges of civilian and child recruitments. For Free Speech Radio News, this is Ponniya Manikavasagam.
Thousands in Pakistan celebrated the reinstatement of a deposed Chief Justice today. Lawyers and opposition parties rallied in Lahore yesterday and threatened to stage a sit-in in front of the parliament in Islamabad today. Mazwar Hussain is there.
Men, women, and even children from all walks of life came to the deposed Chief Justice Chaudhry Iftikhar's house in Islamabad. There was singing and dancing in jubilation. Judge Iftikhar had been dismissed by the former President Pervez Musharraf 2 years ago for hearing cases of people allegedly picked up by government agencies on suspicion of involvement in terrorist activities. Some are said to have been handed over to the United States. Lawyers and conservative opposition parties took out rallies in Lahore Sunday, which turned violent when the police fired tear gas to stop them from marching towards Islamabad. Protesters defied all hurdles and were on their way to Islamabad when the Zardari government, accused of following Musharraf's pro-US policies, announced the reinstatement of the popular judge. Strong-headed Judge Iftikhar can remove the amnesty Musharraf granted to President Zardari against corruption charges, which will make him ineligible for the presidency. Masroor Hussain, Free Speech Radio News, Islamabad.
After 146 years of operation, the Seattle Post-Intelligencer has announced that tomorrow's print edition will be its last. From Seattle, Mark Taylor Canfield.
The Hearst Corporation announced today that it is closing the print edition of the Seattle Post-Intelligencer after 9 years of operating at a financial loss. The newspaper, established in 1863, was put up for sale in January of this year, but no potential buyers stepped forward. The Post Intelligencer has been run by a joint operating agreement with the Seattle Times since 1983, with both papers maintaining separate news and editorial departments. According to the Hearst Corporation, the Seattle PI experienced $14 million in losses last year. The paper plans to continue limited news operations through their website, but 150 employees will lose their jobs. The Seattle Times, which has also been experiencing major financial losses, will remain the only major daily newspaper in Seattle. This is Mark Taylor Canfield in Seattle for Free Speech Radio News.
Bolivian President Evo Morales took from the rich and gave to the poor over the weekend, saying the move would stop human rights abuses of indigenous citizens. Morales gave the deeds to nearly 40,000 hectares of land to the Guarani people and another 17,000 to the communal lands of origin. Morales said that while continuing to respect private property rights, this redistribution of land is the beginning of the end of giant property holdings in Bolivia. For Free Speech Radio News from WMNF Community Radio in Tampa, I'm Nell Abram.
El Salvador's Marxist guerrilla movement-turned-political party has claimed victory at the polls. With about 90% of the votes counted, preliminary official results indicate a 2% lead by the FMLN's Mauricio Funes, who will take the presidency after a 20-year reign by the far-right Arena Party. The United States sought to crush the FMLN during El Salvador's 12-year civil war, which claimed the lives of some 70,000 people. But despite his party's revolutionary past, Funes campaigned on the need for change and reconciliation and wants to maintain positive diplomatic relations with the U.S. Joaquin Chavez is a fellow at the Department of History at NYU. He's in San Salvador. Joaquin, can you tell me what it feels like today in El Salvador?
There is a sense of calmness and, in a way, relief, I believe, from many sectors. Mauricio Funes, elected president, was extremely conciliatory, very respectful towards political adversaries, and basically called for a government of national unity. And that, I think, for the most part, has been well received by the former government party. I was particularly struck by an editorial that appears in the Diario de Hoy, which is the most conservative newspaper in the country, and a staunch adversary of the left. It's an editorial written by Fabricio Altamirano, one of the owners of the newspaper, basically accepting Funes' offer to promote dialogue and negotiation with all sectors of society, and so basically welcoming this gesture by Funes. And Funes, this morning, he was on TV as well, and he remarked this as a historical response by, again, some of the more conservative sectors in the country. So I think Salvadoran society is showing an extremely high level of tolerance and political maturity for what it seems this new historical period in the history of the country.
And what do you think that this victory might mean for relations between El Salvador and the U.S.?
I would say that this is a momentous time in that this new left government in El Salvador, Funes has been really clear on his intentions to promote friendly, respectful relations with the U.S., but also he was very clear on his intention to promote an independent foreign policy as well, the basis for the relations between the U.S. And El Salvador, in this case, will be somewhat different. It will be perhaps not a relation of subordination that has been pretty much the case so far, but rather a more or less egalitarian relation among sovereign states. The very basis by Funes is this idea of respectful and friendly relations with the U.S. I think the Obama government as well has shown from before the election produced official statement basically saying that they will remain neutral during the election, and that was pretty much what they did. Perhaps the first post-war election in which the U.S. government has not directly intervened in favor of one particular political force in the country. Right?
So what's next for El Salvador? What can we expect when Funes assumes power on the 1st of June?
I think the most important thing in my mind is that there would be a serious negotiation on economic and social policies As you probably remember, during the 1992 peace accords, political reform was agreed between the parties involved in the negotiation. And also, I think the other major change will be issues of transparency and in governance. And I think that Funes is very aware of that. And I think that's one of the main areas in which he will be trying to make a difference.
Well, Joaquin, thanks for taking some time to speak with me today.
Hello, it's my pleasure.
Joaquin Chavez is a fellow at the Department of History at NYU. He joined us today from San Salvador. The FMLN's Mauricio Funes is offering to collaborate with current President Antonio Saca for a smooth transition. You're listening to FSRN. I'm Aura Bogado. New details are emerging on the Bush administration's use of torture. A leaked Red Cross document describes incidents of torture in graphic detail. The organization's use of the word torture implies that the Red Cross believes that the interrogation practices violated international law. Meanwhile, President Obama made another move to distance himself from Bush-era terror policies, but critics say it may just be cosmetic. Tanya Snyder reports.
The International Committee of the Red Cross didn't mean for their document to be released to the public. Spokesperson Bernard Barrett says they regret that information attributed to an ICRC document was leaked in this way.
We have access to these places on the understanding that we're not going to go public and discuss these things publicly. And at the same time, if we want to bring about change, we have to develop sort of a relationship of confidence, if you will, with the people in charge.
The document was quoted extensively in a New York Review of Books article by Professor Mark Danner, dated April 9, 2009. The voices quoted are those of the detainees themselves, people being held at the so-called black site prisons operated by the CIA in other countries. The detainees' stories of abuse led the Red Cross to affirm that the interrogation methods used by the CIA constitute torture. Tom Parker was a counter-terrorist officer in the UK for 6 years. Now he's a policy director at Amnesty International. He says the document is significant because the ICRC is the leading institution on the planet investigating detainee treatment.
These are the people who police the Geneva Conventions, and when they throw around and use words like torture and cruel, inhuman, and degrading treatment, they know what they're talking about. Both of those things amount to war crimes.
The Red Cross report was sent to the General Counsel of the CIA 2 years ago and was meant to be read only by senior government officials. It is not meant to provide evidence for prosecution of anyone responsible for violating international law. Meanwhile, the Obama administration has distanced itself from the Bush policy of labeling detainees enemy combatants. The Justice Department filed court papers Friday outlining Obama's standards for holding terrorism suspects without court review. The new standards limit executive authority in determining the status of detainees and the way they are tried.
What changed on Friday was absolutely nothing.
Stephen Abraham worked in U.S. military intelligence for decades, even sitting on combatant status review tribunals established by the Bush administration. He was the first such officer to protest the administration's policies of indefinite detention, first internally and then publicly. He serves on the Constitution Project's Liberty and Security Committee.
You're still describing precisely the same people who have been subjected to this treatment, and you're still adhering to a definition that can apply to anyone who engages in any conduct that tends to injure this nation, its people, its economy.
The phrase enemy combatant refers to an opponent in war. Some critics, like Amnesty's Tom Parker, think the term was inappropriate because it gave too much credit to terrorists.
And so you're elevating the people that you're fighting against to the stature of soldiers instead of treating them as criminals. This is why the Bush administration also used the term unlawful combatant, which hasn't been mentioned in this statement, because that, you know, reflects more accurately this idea that these people are not fighting fair, that they don't carry their weapons openly, they don't wear uniforms. But enemy combatants are a term of art that is used for one army fighting another army.
The new standards also call for detention only of people who provided substantial assistance to the Taliban, al-Qaeda, and other terrorist groups. Abraham says the inclusion of the word is meaningless.
You ask the question, what does substantial mean? It's really in the eye of the beholder. It's an undefinable term. In other words, as the government itself suggested in its briefing on Friday, let us decide on a case-by-case basis who meets this definition. Which is to say, it's not really a defining term then. It's a comfort word.
Attorney General Eric Holder has signaled that more changes will be coming as the new administration works to undo policies that were widely condemned as violations of international law. For Free Speech Radio News, I'm Tanya Snyder in Washington.
AIG's decision to award massive bonuses may result in a subpoena. New York's attorney general says the insurance giant's CEO must make public the names of those getting bonuses or risk a subpoena for the information. AIG has received $170 billion in bailout funds, and the company's decision to award bonuses has also garnered President Obama's attention. He's urging Treasury Secretary Tim Geithner to block the move.
I mean, how do they justify this outrage to the taxpayers who are keeping the company afloat? In the last 6 months, AIG has received substantial sums from the U.S. Treasury. And I've asked Secretary Geithner to use that leverage and pursue every single legal avenue to block these bonuses.
AIG's derivative traders are the ones responsible for credit default swaps, which brought AIG into financial instability. The company has paid them $165 million in bonuses. President Obama and the Treasury Department also released plans today to assist small businesses in getting loans. In an effort to reduce fees and gain access, Treasury Secretary Geithner put pressure on banks to make money available, FSRN's Leanne Caldwell reports.
The tightened credit markets have had severe consequences for small businesses. President Obama outlined the problem.
So, community banks cannot bring in the funds necessary to provide as many loans. And as a result, we've seen a precipitous drop in lending to small business. The SBA typically guarantees $20 billion in loans annually, but this year lending may fall below $10 billion. Even businesses with impeccable credit can't access loans.
His plan is a combination of spending government dollars to boost capital and guaranteeing loans to boost confidence. To provide capital, the plan targets the secondary market, where many small business loans are made and resold. The government will purchase $15 billion of SBA, or Small Business Administration, loan-backed securities. The banks will have more incentive to start making loans because the government will guarantee up to 90% of loans made through the SBA. Also, small businesses will see lower fees for obtaining loans. David Beck, policy director for Center for Community Self-Help, which lends to low-income borrowers, says the plan is a good mix of solutions.
I think this is a big step in the right direction. We think it will unfreeze credit markets to small businesses.
Banks are also pleased with the plan, as their loans will be guaranteed. James Ballantine is a senior vice president at the American Bankers Association.
I think anything at this point helps, and these seem very helpful. Clearly, a lot of things have been tried, a lot of things will be tried, and we'll probably see more in the future. Each announcement gets better, and this one provides a great advance for businesses and for the bankers that are out there trying to serve the business needs.
But the announcement also provided a stern message to banks. Here's Treasury Secretary Timothy Geithner.
Credit is essential to economic recovery, and we need our nation's banks to go the extra mile in keeping credit lines in place on reasonable terms for viable businesses. When banks individually pull back out of a sense of prudence and caution, the collective impact of those actions will make the economy weaker and make each individual bank worse off. Because by pulling back on credit, you push businesses to pull back, and this dynamic can feed on itself.
Lenders and bankers appear pleased, but small businesses, the intended recipients, are concerned. The program helps small businesses that obtain loans through the Small Business Administration. William Dennis, senior research fellow at the National Federation of Independent Business, which represents small businesses in all 50 states, says only 1% of small businesses receive loans through the SBA.
In some ways, it's kind of discouraging because they go back to the same old 7(a) loan program or the same old small business programs for the Small Business Administration, rather than doing things like trying to use the community banks and things of that nature who have many, many more small business customers. And We're much more in tune with small business owners.
Dennis also says loan assistance does not address the number one problem, hurting business because of low sales and lack of customers. For Free Speech Radio News, I'm Leanne Caldwell.
After a two-year combined effort by human rights groups and migrant workers, the Lebanese Ministries of Labor and Social Justice promised to enact a unified contract for migrant domestic workers, a community that numbers more than 200,000 in Lebanon and are still legally considered servants rather than employees, Simba Russo reports.
The new demands agreed upon by a steering committee will be included in a new contract and could be a step forward for migrant rights in Lebanon. It also marks the first time that the employee and employer would read the same contract in their own language. Nadim Houri is a senior researcher at Human Rights Watch.
So the contract, for example, will say that the positive things, the migrants will, the maximum hours of work per day are supposed to be 10 hours of work per day. A migrant will have to be guaranteed 8 hours of rest, continuous rest at night. It guarantees 24 hours off per week. Now, it does not guarantee that these 24 hours will be to go out. This remains to be negotiated between the employer and employee.
Migrant workers who have taken on a lead role in their communities, along with groups such as Human Rights Watch, presented the contract to the government ministries. The contract would also tackle the problem of salary. Due to lack of protection for female migrants by their governments and host countries, many freelance domestic workers have created social networking communities by providing shelter for those that run away and speaking out along with civil and human rights groups. Amy is a domestic worker from Madagascar. She came to Lebanon 11 years ago.
Sometimes I wonder why I put myself in this area, but it's very hard. The consulate before is very bad. That's why I was very much involved before, because I see my people, my countrymen, they are in a deep distress.
Workers are therefore still demanding a new decree that will increase the regulation of placement agencies, which at the moment are not accountable to anyone. They also want the ministry to amend the labor law to include migrant domestic workers under Article 6 to be considered employees rather than servants, which is their current status, one that does not grant them any rights or protection whatsoever. Angelique is a domestic worker from Sudan who came to Lebanon to escape war in her country. Daily, she fears the possibility of imprisonment due to her status as a refugee.
We have need in terms of education. We have needs in terms of health care. The most need is to have protection, legal protection, to be given legal rights.
There's also the issue of physical abuse and suicides, which is difficult to address because of isolation and the lack of social protection. The Caritas Migrant Center is one of few organizations in Lebanon that offers a 24-hour counseling hotline and shelter for victims of abuse.
There are so many who run away for legitimate reasons, but they don't have a place to go, and they are being taken advantage of. The shelters are not enough.
Although this is a major step to achieving basic rights for domestic workers in Lebanon, the women still feel there is a major issue that needs to be addressed in the contract, that they should not have their passports taken by their employers, but should be able to provide them with a photocopy. Naime Pelo is a domestic worker from Kenya.
They are caught on the street because they don't have papers, and they don't have papers because the employers don't let them keep the passports.
But the absence of protection for their nationals has prompted key labor source countries to restrict travel to Lebanon. Last year, Ethiopia officially banned its citizens from coming to work in Lebanon, while since November 2007, migrant Philippine workers are only legally permitted to travel to Lebanon if paid a minimum of $400 per month. Sri Lanka is now considering banning women migrant domestic workers from going to many countries in the Middle East, including Lebanon, starting in 2009, according to Human Rights Watch. This is Simba Rousseau reporting for Free Speech Radio News in Beirut.
A devastating flood hit the northern Indian state of Bihar last year, displacing millions of people. 6 months on, most of the displaced have not been able to return to their homes. Hundreds of miles away in New Delhi, many of them are now on hunger strike, demanding immediate rehabilitation. Bismila Gilani has the story.
About 200 men and women clamor for attention near the Parliament House in New Delhi. They are the survivors of the floods that wreaked havoc in the northern state of Bihar in August 2008. Many of them lost their homes, cattle, fields, and all other possessions in the tragedy, but haven't yet received any help from the government. 38-year-old Santosh Singh is a laborer from Sahrsa district of Bihar.
The government did not fulfill its duty. They only made promises and did a little bit of relief work in the beginning and then forgot everything. Now the situation is even worse than it was at the time of the floods. Those who lost their homes have no shelter. A large part of the agricultural land is no longer farmable and people have no food. It's a starvation-like situation in North Bihar and many people are now migrating to other places.
Bihar, one of India's most impoverished states, has always been prone to floods. The Kosi River is a lifeline to the state's more than 80 million population, which is heavily dependent on agriculture. But the river turns into a source of death and destruction every year, and the devastation caused by floods last year was unparalleled. Nearly 2,000 people were killed and more than 3 million displaced when the river breached its eastern embankment in Nepal and changed its course, drowning hundreds of villages and towns. Social activist Devchand Vishwatma blames the government for the tragedy.
It wasn't a natural calamity, it was a man-made disaster. When you build a large embankment and it collapses, the destruction will be at a larger scale. This time, the erosion was noticed earlier, but for 10 days, the government did nothing. It was a case of gross negligence. Even now, the Kosi project is being built in such a way that will cause further problems.
In 1954, a 22-kilometer-long embankment was built on both sides of the river under a treaty between India and Nepal. India had taken responsibility of its maintenance. Most of the affected families are still living in the makeshift relief camps, but with no access to clean water, adequate food, and proper medical care, many have been falling prey to various diseases. Pila Ram is member of Ekta Parishad, an NGO helping in the relief work.
डूबने से तो बचा लिया गया लोगों को घूमने से बचा लिया गया लेकिन जो लंबा एक इनको इलाज चाहिए वो इलाज नहीं हो रहा है ना तो नया कुआं आपने
People were saved from drowning but they are not getting the medical care they need. The wells and other water sources in the area are filled with water that came from the floods and had even dead bodies in it but still people have been drinking the same water.
वही पानी जो बाढ़ में आया था कुआं में जो भरा हुआ था
Because the government did not make any arrangements for safe water diseases like malaria and diarrhea are widespread.
While the protesters in New Delhi have attracted support from many individuals and groups, the government has not yet responded. The protesters have threatened to prolong their hunger strike for an indefinite period if their demand for immediate rehabilitation is not met. For FSRN, this is Bismillah Gilani from New Delhi.
And that wraps up today's newscast. From Pacifica Station KPFK in Los Angeles, I'm Aura Abogado.